Whoop.
Good evening. Good evening. If you could take your seats, we'll call this meeting to order. Welcome. This is the Morro Bay City Council meeting for Tuesday, March 22nd, 2011. Let the record show that all council members are present. And not to scare you, but I am, as the acting vice mayor, holding down the chair for Mayor Yates as he and our city manager, Ms. Luker, are in Washington, D.C. for the California Marine Affairs and Navigation Conference. And they're there in a grant-funded trip. Thank you. To start tonight off, we have requested a special informational presentation by Mr. Larry Allen from the County Air Pollution Control District in regards to the radiation concerns from the issues over in Japan, their nuclear power plant there. And we appreciate Larry for being here today and to discuss what we could expect here in our county. Yeah, we would. We're just taking care of the mic. Mr. Allen will be followed by our Chief Pons, who discussed a few of the issues surrounding the iodine tablets that many people are hearing about, and to give a brief review of what we would need or expect to be warned with if the situation were to escalate, which at this point it's not expected to be getting to that level, but we have a very substantial plan in place if it were to get that far, and Mr. Pond will describe that as well. Larry, you could grab one of these other microphones.
There we go.
Great. Oh, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, I think. And the Air Pollution Control District is not typically involved in nuclear radiation issues other than from an emergency response standpoint. We tend to deal with the more traditional pollutants of ozone and particulate matter and carbon monoxide and now greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, and so forth. But given the level of public concern regarding this, we've been asked by the County Office of Emergency Services and the Department of Public Health to kind of step in and help field public questions related to the travel of these pollutants and how they disperse and what kind of concentrations are we likely to see once they get here. And so I've rapidly been coming up to speed on this, and we really the experts in this nation and even locally tend to be at the federal level because that is where the regulation occurs. And so the Nuclear Regulatory Commission deals with the regulations on that, and the Environmental Protection Agency does all the monitoring. And so we're coordinating closely with them and with the county OES and with the Public Health Department in looking at this. And I just have a few slides to show you. The first one is that there is an extensive monitoring network in place throughout the United States, and it was installed initially basically as part of the nuclear test ban treaty so that we could detect any type of radiation testing that is happening anywhere in the world. And so the monitors that are in place are incredibly sensitive. They detect down to levels that are literally thousands of times below the public health thresholds for radiation because they want to pick up anything that's happening out there. We have 12 such monitors in California. They're monitoring on a real-time basis, and that data is available from EPA's RadNet monitoring network, and I'll show you a link that you can go to later to see that information. So we have 12 monitors in California. They're in the major metropolitan areas, north to south and east to west, from San Diego up to the Bay Area and then across through the valley. And we also have a statewide network that is also in place because of the nuclear power plants in California. And they're operated by the California Department of Public Health. There's actually one in Avila and one in San Luis Obispo at the Public Health Agency. And so we see that data as well. And then, of course, there's local monitoring network for the Diablo Canyon power plant, and they have monitors out in Avila, Pismo, Grover Beach, San Luis Obispo, Morro Bay, Montana de Oro, Los Osos, and at the power plant itself. And so we've been working to track what those levels are and coordinating the response to the public on that. And just to kind of give folks an idea of what common levels are, and you can't read those, but let's see, I do have a chart here that I can read from. So what this is showing is the tallest green bar on the right there is the annual nuclear worker dose limit that's set by the NRC. And then the next one, and that's at 5,000 milligrams. And one of the things, if you ever go on the sites to try and look at what the plant allowed is 100. You have radioactive compounds in your body from potassium and naturally occurring potassium iodide down around 40. All the way down to a transatlantic flight, you take a transatlantic flight and you're going to be exposed to about 2.5 milligrams of radiation. The concentrations that we are measuring right now in locally and throughout the state are literally thousands of times below the lowest level that you would see for a transatlantic flight. And, for instance, and you're not going to be able to tell right here, but just to give you an example of what they look like, here's one of the RadNet monitoring sites in San Francisco. And that line down the middle is March 11th. And so it goes all the way from, I think the first date on there is March 2nd. And then it's going, the last part of the chart you see there is current, March 23rd. And what you can see, there was a huge spike out there actually on March 2nd, probably due to a solar flare or something like that, which it's important to understand that background levels can fluctuate quite considerably, and you can see that there's really not much difference there in what they're measuring from before the accident to today. This one is from Anaheim, California, and they're showing their natural background is apparently slightly higher down there than in San Francisco, but you can see that there's relatively little difference between what they were measuring before the accident and what they're measuring today. This is Bakersfield, so further over into the valley, you can see that the natural background over there is quite a bit higher than it is in either the Bay Area or down in Southern California, and yet you can see that there's really not an appreciable difference in what they're measuring today than what they were before. Keep in mind that even like the biggest spike that you see over there on, I guess that's March 19th or 20th, is literally thousands of times below the safe public thresholds for human health. So we're seeing quite low levels here. And the California Department of Public Health and the California Emergency Management Agencies held a press conference 2 days ago, and they pretty much stated unequivocally that even under worst-case scenarios, any radioactive particles that reach our shores are not expected to be above background levels and do not present a public health risk for California residents. And so that's coming from the folks that know the business. And the reason why is because that radioactive material has to travel over 5,000 miles across literally millions of acres or millions of square miles of ocean where it will be significantly diluted and dispersed before it ever hits our shores. And And so it does not represent right now a significant health threat, and that situation is not expected to change. We're exposed every day to low levels of radiation from natural sources that are always present and that don't represent a health threat. Those include radioactive elements in the Earth's crust, radiation from cosmic rays from outer space, and also solar radiation. And the normal fluctuations in those background radiation levels can be a whole lot greater than the small levels of radioactive material that might reach us from the nuclear incident in Japan. So the take-home message is that we're not expecting to see anything that's going to rise to the level of a public health concern. Nonetheless, we are tracking this situation every day. We're working closely with the County Office of Emergency Services and the Public Health Department to keep the public informed. There's a number of resources that people can check for further info. We have a link on our website now to several good pieces of information. If you go to slowcleanair.org, and right off to the right, you'll see something related to the Japan nuclear issue. You click on that, and there's some good information. There were some good links inside it. There's also a link to the Office of Emergency Services site and the Public Health Department with similar information, as well as the EPA RadNet network, the California Emergency Management Agency, and so forth. And so you have this here. I'll leave you a copy of this if you would like. For anyone that wants to make a copy of this sheet right here, they can have it a hard copy available. And I answer any questions that I can if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Any questions from the council? All right. Thanks for your time and work on this.
You bet.
And I'd like to give our Chief Pond a chance to discuss a little bit.
And potassium iodine was recommended by the county health officer. The public would be notified through the emergency alert system over radios and directed to the proper actions for that incident. There's also the countywide siren system that can also alert you if you're not listening to the radio or TV that something's going on. Go to radio or TV, the websites, and find out what you're supposed to do. But again, for this incident, there's no concern and no anticipated direction from the county health officer to take any potassium iodide. Potassium iodide is typically a benign substance, but there are some people who are sensitive to it that can have an allergic reaction to the iodine. Also, it can cause nausea, it can cause some intestinal issues, some rashes. So it's nothing that you want to take just to be taking it. And it's not a preventative medicine that you would take in advance of an exposure. You take it if there's an immediate need from something that is imminent from something close by, such as the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. There are places in our county where you can get it. There's the Los Osos medicine shop at 1199 Los Osos Valley Road. There's four other places in the county, but the medicine shop in Los Osos is the closest. The county is still distributing the KI, but only to those people who live in the protective action zones identified in our county. There are 12 protective action zones. Morro Bay is in protective or PAS number 9. You need to go online to get a voucher, and then you can pick that up. But, again, that would only be to have in hand if someday something were to occur at Diablo Canyon. But for this incident, there's no concern.
Thank you, Mr. Pond. And just to continue with that, we did feel some effects from the earthquake event in Japan, and that was our tsunami experience here up and down the coast. And your departments, along with the Harbor Department and all city staff and volunteers, did an excellent job on behalf of the council of responding to that and setting up an emergency operations center. And I would like to give you some time to just briefly debrief the community on that process and what you guys saw.
Well, thank you for that. I'll start out, and then I'm going to turn it over to Eric Endersby, our Chief Harbor Patrol Officer. People have been asking about the process, how we get notified, what we do when we hear of a large earthquake and a potential tsunami. So I'm going to kind of go through that procedure. The earthquake occurred in Japan. It was initially an 8.9, later increased to a 9.0, generated a local tsunami with severe damage, a lot of loss of life. Almost immediately, it went out over the air on TV media, NOAA websites, USGS websites, a number of places that we were tracking. The Pacific Warning Tsunami Warning Center and the Alaska West Coast Tsunami Warning Center monitored the situation, initially put out an advisory for the West Coast United States. We continued to monitor that. As city staff, those on-duty fire police personnel started reviewing the city's multi-hazard emergency response plan. I brought it here so people can see kind of what it looks like. Within that multi-hazard emergency response plan is Annex H, which addresses tsunamis. So our staff started reviewing that and seeing what we would need to do if that advisory moved to the next level. About 12:44 in the morning on the 11th, advisory went to a warning, which is the highest level. At that time, notifications went out to the city manager, police chief, fire chief, other department heads. And we held our first meeting at the police department, limited EOC activation at 2 o'clock in the morning. At that meeting, we monitored the situation. We're gathering information again from those resources I mentioned before. CLETS through CalEMA also passes on information that is gathered through the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center and Alaska Warning Center. Once we were gathered at the police department for the limited activation, we developed two potential scenarios. A 3-foot surge and a 7-foot surge is what it appeared would be coming our way. So we started developing incident action plans for both those scenarios. We sent out staff, police, and harbor to just start making notifications on the waterfront with liveaboard vessels, and putting up barricades and tsunami warning signs at the beach areas, including the high school, the trailer park, wastewater plant, and then all of the Embarcadero. The police department started the development of evacuation plan. They utilized reverse 911, which is initiated at the sheriff's department, and it calls every phone in the identified geographic area and lets them know there's a tsunami warning and that evacuation has been ordered. We also use the emergency alert system, which sends out messages over TV and radio and other medias. Once that evacuation was underway, We continued the development of a written incident action plan, a more thorough plan. We had moved to our regular EOC over the community center. We upgraded and called in all the department heads and extra staff, general alarm for firefighters and other personnel. Police were staffing barricades preventing access to the Embarcadero and other access points to the beach. We had state parks representative in the EOC who addressed the evacuation of both the state parks and Morro Bay. It went very well. We had conference calls with the county EOC and all the cities and districts that border the Pacific Ocean. And so we were all on the same page. We all knew what each other was doing and to what limits we were all evacuating. I think at this point I'll turn it over to Eric Endersby, who can talk a little bit about what occurred locally in the Bay. Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Pond. Good evening, Council. Mike covered the vast majority of it in terms of the response, and I think what shouldn't be left out is, you know, it was a significant event and a pretty eye-opening event, but there were no injuries and no deaths, which isn't necessarily the case in the rest of California. There were some incidents north of us that were a lot worse. So in that sense, we did pretty darn well. We had that Chilean quake last year, and it was, 2 to 4 foot surges that would come in and out over about a 15-minute period, and was a pretty amazing sight. Well, this was like that times 10. We measured on our tide board swings 4 to 9 feet from a high to low over about a 15-minute period, and that created a lot of whirlpools, a lot of cascading water, a lot of cross currents in weird places, a lot of boats with keels, that are in slip sideways to the current were getting pulled over. It's pretty significant. I think all in all, we were pretty well prepared in terms of going through and triaging, getting folks off the water, getting lines tied up, and making sure everybody was pretty well set. The surges went all day Saturday, or all day Friday, for the most part, into Friday night. We even saw some action still on Saturday. We had a lot of folks out there on the water on Saturday, a lot of people kayaking because it was a pretty nice day, and had a few times where folks would go up onto the sand spit, pull their kayaks up above what they thought was the high tide line, and 10 minutes later, the high tide line's 10 feet higher than they were before. So still had some things going on Saturday. By Sunday, we still had a little bit of action going on. You could still see when the tide's coming in, boats would be turning the wrong way, and so it was reverberating throughout the whole Pacific Basin, obviously, for a while. From an operational standpoint, everybody was real cooperative. We got the liveaboards out. Everybody understood the severity of it, not knowing, exactly what was going to come. Obviously, better safe than sorry. And I think the system worked pretty well. Damage-wise, we had, on our facilities that we operate as a city, we had one dock destroyed, a pile knocked over, one other pile in another location, broken wooden pile, and possibly a second. A little bit of damage to a couple of our boats. The most significant damage seemed to be back in the State Park Marina. They had a lot of water because all over the back bay, just all this water instantly just coming in and flooding and then pulling out. And, the State Park Marina basin would fill up and it would all flood out. It was kind of a little mini bay. And they had a boat break loose in there that ended up on the rocks, a little wooden boat that ended up sinking. Minor pollution incident came out of that. Their kayak dock, one of their kayak docks was destroyed and flipped over. And they had some damage to some of their fingers. So they seemed to suffer the worst of the damage. Bridge of Sport Fishing had some pile and dock damage. Some other miscellaneous vessel damage that we've kind of heard through word of mouth here and there. But all in all, our sort of windshield assessment, which is not real scientific or not really getting down and sharpening our pencils, just going, okay, this dock, yeah, it'll be about that much. We came to an estimate of about $455,000.
Which is pretty light considering the numbers coming out of
pretty light when you look at
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz, Crescent City, very light, very fortunate. Fort Bragg, yeah.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
For your response on that, and I was impressed to see the volunteers that came out to help support our staff, and that everyone did a very good job of entertaining their curiosity but not getting into harm's way while doing that. The bluffs were packed with people, but that was deemed a safe place and seemed like everyone was respecting that to the best of their ability.
If I could just add one more thing that I did forget. We had, the typical prudent mariner
emergency. We sent a request to the state as well asking for a state emergency. That was declared for the county of San Luis Obispo. FEMA, CalEMA, and County OES visited with us last Friday to document the damage. They did advise us that potential funding for reimbursement for this event is only going to be for public losses to facilities and things. Private boats, private docks, and revenues lost would not be included for reimbursement at this time.
Okay, thank you. Before we go on to the council announcements, I would like to give Mr. Woods a chance to update the community on the PG&E work being done over Highway 1 with the power lines, which has generated a lot of curiosity.
Thank you and good evening. I had a chance to speak with a representative from PG&E. They are contracting out the work that's being done there. They're replacing the lattice towers within the plant. And to do that, they've got to secure the line that goes over Highway 1. And secure that line, they've set up some temporary poles on both sides of the highway. And those poles are anchored by guide wires and certain anchors that tie them and secure them. Within the city's jurisdiction, is on the west side of the highway, which is in the bike path. And the bike path has the temporary poles located, and they are anchored and wired and anchored close to the bike path, partially obstructing the bike path. But currently the bike path is open partially obstructed, but also signed for safety. When there is significant work on the bike path or in that area, PG&E contractors will be monitoring any pedestrians or bikes going through that area, and they'll be escorting them personally through the area, through the safety construction zone. Right now, the work is slowed down because of the inclement weather. They're trying to be safe as possible. There was a highway closure today. I don't know how long it was closed, but it was a temporary close that was orchestrated by Caltrans and their specifications as far as the type of work that's going on. This work, they basically have committed to the work to the end of April and early May. They're hoping to get done sooner. The bike path will continue to be open, and the poles and the temporary structures are looking to be removed no later than the 1st of May.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Woods. Announcements from council members? Ms. Borchard?
Good evening. Thank you. Several events and activities coming up. I see some people here that will probably be speaking to them, so I won't go into detail, but just to let the public know. There is the Dixon Spaghetti Feed that's this Friday at the Community Center. Benefits the Community Foundation Scholarships for the Youth, and it's from 4:30 to 7. Tickets are available at the door. Thursday, the 24th, is a 6 o'clock meeting for Relay for Life, and that's at Morro Grill. 5:30 Eco Rotary meeting. On the 24th also, and that's at the Flying Dutchman. Some of the committees that I sit on just met the last few weeks, and just a brief update on those. The Community Action Partners is working with San Luis County right now and moving forward with the new homeless shelter. And also the Prado Day Center has been opened extended hours during the rains, so they are in need of food and other items that anybody who's interested in donating can contact them. I attended my first Warden's Advisory meeting at CMC, and they're in the same situation everybody is in the state with their budgets and things. And the one problem that just was something they were discussing in length was about the illegal cell phone usage that the inmates seem to be getting. So that's their hot topic right now. The citywide yard sale is April 2nd and 3rd, and Tip-A-Cop dinner on April 8th at the Community Center benefits the Special Olympics. Thank you. I couldn't think about it. And that's the same day at Morro Bay High School. They have X the Text, which is going to be an assembly about not using your texting while you're driving. So a lot of things coming up.
Okay. I also attended my county meetings this last couple of weeks. One of them was the Homeless Services Oversight Committee. And several items that they're working on. I won't go into all of those, but as Carla said, Prado is opening at night with the cold weather, and they need volunteers and help. Whatever you can take down there or your time would be great.
At the city's website, which is the Morro Bay, City of Morro Bay website, transit section, and you'd be able to find it by just going to the homepage. We are asking these to be returned by April 1st.
I just want to congratulate the 4th of July committee for a great successful fundraiser at the had at the Harbor Hut. It was delightful. All the rain and everything didn't keep people away, and this committee works real hard. I just want to recognize them as just guys out there doing a great job for an event that we need very much in Morro Bay. And one of the little embarrassing things, John Barta, could you go get my water off the sink I left in the men's bathroom, please? Thank you, John.
It's good to have friends out there, huh?
What are you going to do without John?
Yeah. Mr. Schultz, can we have a closed session report?
Yes, good evening. Prior to tonight's regular session, council met in closed session to discuss labor negotiations. No reportable action was taken by council. It requires reporting under the Brown Act.
Thank you. And with that, we'll move on to public comment where members of the audience wishing to address the council on items with business before the city may do so. We'll have 3 minutes to speak. And actually, we're going to lead with two public speakers. First will be our Chamber of Commerce and Mr. Weiss with a check presentation, followed by our business spotlight, which is Studio One, and then we'll get into the rest of public comment.
All right, well, this is a good news moment. I want to first of all thank the council for allowing us to present a check at this time. And as the president of the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce, it is an honor to partner with all the events that come to Morro Bay. And Craig can attest to the cooperation that we provide in all events, including the 4th of July, which is a great event. It's a family-friendly event, and it needs help. It needs funding. It needs people to provide their financial support as well as their time, and so it's a great honor for the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce to present a check for $1,500 to the Morro Bay 4th. And I might also comment that Chris Christensen will make some comments. He's on the Morro Bay Chamber Board as well, and he's also president-elect, so I'm really happy to see him.
Thank you very much, Craig. Thank you. Well, council members and George, thank you for your kind comments about our committee. We do work hard. We do it because we love Morro Bay, and we want to see Morro Bay be successful, and that's really what we stand for. And the only reason we do it is to help Morro Bay to thrive and be a healthy little community. And 4th of July is one of those events that helps that to happen. But we couldn't do it alone, and I can't accept this check or your thank yous and your accolades without mentioning the help that we get from this community, starting with you guys. Without your support, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have the motivation that we have. And all of you, individually, corporately, from the city attorneys on down to every one of you up there, have been so encouraging and helpful to keep us motivated as we go along. And your encouragement through not only the city council, but your committees like the hoteliers, the business improvement district, the CPC, our community promotion committees, city council, chamber of commerce, harbor commission, all of you make this worthwhile and make it happen. The public will have an opportunity to join with all of you by donating monies through their water bill again this year. We encourage them to do that. We still need money, but because of the participation and the leaders in this community, we're at least 75% of the way to guaranteeing that we'll have fireworks again this year. So thank you again.
Mr. Suchek? And company.
Bear with me and my crew. Thank you for allowing me to brag about my business. Name is Bill Suchek, along with my wife Tracy. We own what I would call a rather unique store along the Embarcadero in Marina Square, 601 Embarcadero to be specific. It's called Suite One. Now, what Suite One is, if we can spin that around, you can kind of get a... Suite One is not just a retail store. It's a full-functioning gallery. What my wife and I have done is actually chosen artwork from around the world, as well as some local artists, which you see some of them behind me. And what we do is we offer, we're the only store that offers someplace you can actually come see art, you can come purchase art, which we hope. And the big thing is something you can actually produce your own art. We offer art classes, which my crew here is in charge of. These faces in the store that can actually talk about their work, brag about their work, and actually talk intelligently. We are not part-time staff, nothing against them, but we are full-functioning professionals. Okay, I kind of give you a general idea what my store looks like. Sorry for the poor quality, this was quick. It's 2,400 square feet. I moved from a 675 square foot store to a 2,400 square foot store October 1. And what we offer is sectional areas of jewelry. When Tracy sold her jewelry store at the end of June of last year, we merged our ideas of taking my photography, her jewelry, other artists, and actually making a classroom. I've got a small classroom, only will handle about 8 people at a time. It's actually perfect. It's perfect attention that we need to make sure that clients do the right thing. We don't want anybody walking out of the store confused about how they actually produce or create art. And this is where this one-on-one or close to one-on-one attention actually comes to play. Okay? Just want to make sure it's 601 Embarcadero, Marina Square, lower level, called Suite 1. I've had some problems with the phones in the past couple months. It's 4972 is the number. And the email account is suite1morrobay@gmail.com. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll proceed into the rest of public comment, please.
Good evening. My name is Betty Winholtz. I want to make note of the fact that Morro Bay was on the front page of the Tribune last Friday. They were noting our permit application that went through a stumbling block up at the Coastal Commission, and that it's been sent back to us as a deficient. Many of the things that were noticed as deficient were things that scores of residents, including myself, had brought before the council, in terms of alternative technology, alternative site location, water reclamation, and others. Things that had been pointed out to us by the Planning Commission, who had actually recommended to the former City Council not to permit this project and send it forward. So I'm here tonight to ask you to make note of that, to recognize that the last council and staff had actually gambled over $300,000 putting forward a deficient document that was not successful, and we lost that. And that now they've convinced you to put forward over $100,000 on hiring a lobbyist who has some question about to try to be successful at the Coastal Commission level. And it's my understanding that that kind of work with the Coastal Commission was supposed to happen with the project manager. So now are we paying two different people to do the same job? So a lot of financial waste, in my opinion, and when you add in that the designs that's gone forward that's no longer relevant, my guess is that we're close to $500,000 that's been wasted of ratepayers' money that could have gone towards infrastructure of the new power plant or the new physical wastewater treatment plant. So I'm asking you to take the opportunity to be the council that will correct the situation, to get a hold of this constant hiring of consultants, to cut back on the fat, to stop gambling with our money, to stop what I consider the bleeding of the taxpayer rate here for our plant, and that includes you as ratepayers, that includes the businesses in town that we've just seen, and that includes the residents. Thank you.
Good evening. Here we go. Good evening, Council. David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility and resident here in Morro Bay. This evening we've heard some rather sobering comments from our fire chief as well as the Air Pollution Control District, concern over an incident that actually happened 5,000 miles away, but in all cases reference the fact that the preparations we have in place, whether it's potassium iodide or response plans, are really based on a facility that's actually 11 miles from where we're standing today. And we think we should take this opportunity as a sobering look at the presence of this facility and would request that the council consider joining, among others who have, the San Luis Board of Supervisors, the Santa Barbara Board of Supervisors, and certainly not in the least our state Senator Sam Blakeslee, who has made quite an adamant and forceful concern for the earthquake and seismic hazards that may or may not, depending on the studies that need to be done, be present at the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactor. Mr. Blakeslee, as you may have seen in the Tribune today, has called on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to halt this application until further and substantive studies can be completed. The San Luis Board of Supervisors has already sent such a letter, as has the one in Santa Barbara as well. And we think it might be wise for this council to also consider that summer, crippling and destroying their economy, just on perception alone. And so it does behoove us to take a look at our own local situation, and I would encourage this council to consider agendizing a similar letter to the one our supervisors and state senator are sending to the officials dealing with this situation. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joan Solu, and I'm the Del Mar PTA president, and Del Mar School is the only elementary school here in town, and we're having our biggest social scene of the year, which is our Del Mar Art Auction and Fundraiser coming up on Sunday, April 10th, and we have beautiful pieces of art like Brandon is displaying here, and this was made by Miss Williams' kindergarten class. Each class produces a lovely piece of art, and we do have the California's number one state auctioneer come out and put on his live performance of auctioning off several wonderful items. This year, we'd like to thank our community for helping us and giving us these wonderful items. They include dinners from Windows, the Galley, Harbor Hut, donations by Carlos Country Kitchen. We have dinner at the Firehouse, which is coming together nicely, and also the very famous and very highly sought after Ride of a Lifetime for the highest bidding class on the final day of school. You get a trolley ride that's escorted with police and fire, and you get to meet the city council. It's really exciting. This is our poster, and I'd like to introduce two of our students, Brandon and Haley Reveille, and she's actually going to speak. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Haley Reveille, and I am a fourth grade student at Del Mar. I would like to invite you all to our Del Mar Art Auction. Our art auction will be held on Sunday, April 10th from 1 o'clock to 4 p.m. All of our future leaders will be there having a great time enjoying our carne asada plates. Some of the festivities, including the bingo cow pop, which the tickets are $10 each for a chance to win $1,000. We have both silent and live auctions. Staff, students, and parents have been working very hard on crafts, so we would like the whole town to show support by showing up to our awesome distinguished school. We are still accepting donations such as gift certificates, artwork, and services. For those who have already donated, we appreciate your gracious gifts. All of our proceeds will be used for classroom technology, field trips, and even including our 4-day, 3-night science camp for sixth graders. We appreciate all your continued support, and we hope to see you there. Thank you.
Good evening, Commissioner Smuckler, members of the council. My name is Gayska Velasquez, and I am the North Coast Planner with the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, or SLOCOG, and I really should have had Haley do this for me, but I'd like to invite you all to a public workshop, our first public workshop as part of the planning efforts for the Coastal Trail in northern San Luis Obispo County. We're really excited about this. We got a grant through the National Scenic Byway Program for the Route 1 San Luis Obispo County Scenic Byway, and we'll be completing a master trail plan for the northern 35 miles of San Luis Obispo County. So that's between the Monterey County line and just north of Cayucas at the Estero Bluffs. So again, the kickoff public workshop is Wednesday, March 30th. That's next Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Cambria Grammar School just off Main Street in Cambria. And we'll be just going over what the project will entail, the goals and objectives, and really giving the public the first opportunity to comment and to give us input on the plan. We are inviting your council and the public tonight. Even though the project area will not include Morro Bay, as residents of the coast and really residents of the county using the coast, we would like everyone's participation. So I do have more flyers if anyone needs it. For additional information, you can call SLOCOG or go to our new website. I have to check it here. It's slowcoastaltrail.com. That should have been easy. But and again, it's next Wednesday night, 7 p.m. at the Cambria Grammar School multipurpose room. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, City Council. My name is Mark Schaefer. I'm the CEO of Funride, the green way to drive. I'm here tonight because the city's considered joining Funride, and we are a car-sharing service that's been in operation for 2 years. We now have 9 vehicles in operation, and the way car-sharing works is for the city, you join for $240 fuel. You get up to 150 miles. And so it's a great service that not only can be used by city employees, visitors, but also seniors are using it, residents in general. Families can get rid of their second car, and when they need an extra car, Funride's always available to them. So we're very excited you're joining the city of San Luis Obispo, the county of San Luis Obispo, the city of Santa Maria. We also have a car in Paso Robles and Grover Beach. And what happens is as more people use the service and more obey, we will continue to provide the green vehicles. And we clean them, we maintain them, we fuel them. You return the vehicle, you don't even have to fuel it. We do that for you. And again, we get brand new hybrids. Hybrids would work better here, but we have natural gas Civics, propane vans, and we'll be getting electric vehicles as well. So I want to encourage you and thank you for the city considering joining Funride, and it's really good for your climate action plan as well. Thank you.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'd like to give a brief report to you and the citizens of Morro Bay about the California Coastal Commission meeting in Santa Cruz on March 11th that I attended. Excuse me, Barry Brannon, Morro Bay. The meeting started at 9 a.m., and the first order of business was a brief update of the threat of the tsunami. This was the day that it hit. Everyone was visibly concerned about the tsunami. The agenda item for wastewater treatment plant started at 10:05. The entire discussion and vote took less than 2 minutes. The Morro Bay project was denied as expected. One of the major items on most of the appeals was the risk of the tsunami. Obviously, someone had a sense of humor to have this occur at the time of the hearing. With the Coastal Commission denial, we must start over, even though we have spent upwards to $500,000 on outside consultants and staff. Most of it's wasted. The project fails because the scope of work was not clearly defined. For example, the plant was designed first, and then the environmental impact report was written around the design. That is backwards, and over $250,000 is wasted on the EIR. Now we are preparing to do the same thing. Last week, a request for proposal was sent out to find a qualified consultant to work on the project. The RFP states the goal is to prepare an analysis of the substantial issues that are identified in the Coastal Commission report. We really don't need to analyze the report. It pretty well tells us what they want. They sent us 14 pages. And again, it appears we're going down the wrong path and we're beating a dead horse. Furthermore, the short bid period is only 15 days. This will not get a wide circulation and means that we will only have the usual suspects quoting. This is not good. Before we restart, the scope needs to be clearly defined. The dictionary defines scope as ultimate intention. To establish and define the scope and get started on the new design, there should be public meetings. The Planning Commission should lead this process. In the scoping meeting, we should look at the true cost of building and operating a plant for the expected life. Not just the design and construction cost, but also the power and labor costs. The following questions are examples of those that need to be asked. What can be done to offset the cost of relocating the plant? Are there revenue-producing uses of the existing property? What design elements would cut the cost of operation? Solar power and the use of gases that are produced in the normal operations are ideas. What other revenue sources and or cost savings can we find? Most of the recycled water can be reused to recharge our aquifer and thus reduce our dependence on state water. I know that we can find another city that needs more water from their state allocation, and we could sell them our portion. When the preliminary scope is established, then and not before, the RFP should be sent out to qualified outside contractors. These contractors should not be involved in the construction. The current RFP is inappropriate. Let's get the scope established first. With the scope defined, the project should then be submitted to the Coastal Commission to see if it will meet their approval. When we have an approved project, A bid request can be written for the design, construction, financing, and operation. Then and only then will we know the true cost to be established, and our ratepayers will be able to see what's coming. Thank you.
Hi, Virginia Hiramatsu, Morro Bay, and I'm representing the Morro Bay Relay for Life. Our kickoff is this Thursday, March 24th at 6 o'clock at the Embarcadero Grill upstairs. We're inviting everybody in the community and Los Osos everywhere to come to the kickoff to learn more about what Relay for Life is all about.
First, the council vote on our city advertising agency that overrode majority decisions of both advisory boards suggests to me that there is somewhat of a disconnect between advisory board actions and council direction. Public comment during that time suggested to me a lack of understanding in the business community about what we do and why. The promotions committee will be making an effort to reach out to the council and business community for a better consensus on goals and objectives. Second, I feel it is critical to have better communication with the council and community members. To this end, I will try to be here once a month to report on recent CPC actions and to receive direction from the council. I'm very pleased that we have a council member attending our meetings and have suggested that we hold regular joint meetings and subcommittee meetings with the TBID. I will also work with the business forum to arrange times for open discussion about our promotion activities. Third, we need to move forward effectively. John Sorgenfrey suggested a citywide workshop to get the community, businesses, boards, and council on the same page with regards to city promotions, image, and advertising. And to most effectively do our job, we should make this happen. With the transition approaching, this is the right time to coordinate an approach to advertising broadly and openly. Fourth, TJA has provided us with a clear advertising plan focused on a variety of demographic groups and communities around California. The ad campaigns are not only targeted in terms of location, income, and age groups, but are seasonal as well. The monthly budget clearly outlines where the advertising dollars are spent in both print and online venues and what times of year campaigns in specific markets are placed. With the new hire, we will continue to review our approach and solicit community input. Fifth, a quick note on our steps forward. TJA is preparing for the transition of our current campaigns and tech platform to the new agency in hopes that we don't have a lag time in our promotion efforts or website availability. Internet and print ads will continue to run as scheduled. New ideas we are exploring include Janice Peters' idea of the appointment of a film commissioner and requisite support package to facilitate more commercial filming in and around Morro Bay. We are also working with the Visitor Center and Chamber staff to explore the expansion of visitor services to satellite centers around town, initially with racks of informational brochures and eventually, hopefully, with interactive digital equipment. We continue to solicit packages from hotel and restaurant industries for the wide variety of events we hold in town. And if you would like to contact me, all my information is on the city website. I do own Beads by the Bay at 333 Morro Bay Boulevard. You can email me, call me, or drop by. Thank you.
Wishing to speak?
Good evening, Acting Mayor, members of the council. My name is John Barta. I wanted to speak on item D1. California is a growing state, and the state is mandating that all the communities share in the burden of where growth should go. As you know, growth can go and can come around in terms of subdivisions, suburban expansion, farmland, conversion, open space development. But let's face it, we don't like those kinds of things here in Morro Bay. But we do have an obligation to meet our so-called fair share housing need. So let's think about the terms that we like to bandy about here. Recycle, reuse. What does those things? How can we take this problem that we have with being obligated to provide a fair share of possible housing in the future with the concepts of recycling and reusing? Well, there is a way to do it, and in the past we've had a rather robust program to do it called a granny unit program. The granny unit program uses existing streets, existing sewers, existing water infrastructure, existing power infrastructure, existing city services infrastructure, does all of those things without having to expand our boundaries or use up farmland or any of those other things. And how does it do it? It does it one family at a time. It allows one family to make a decision to expand, you know, their living situation, and that they can use that for other family members. The kids go to college. Well, maybe they need a place to live while they're in college. Maybe the old folks, you know, after they get a little older and the nest is empty, they would like to live in the granny unit and have the young folks move in. You know, housing is very expensive, into the front unit. There's all this family flexibility stuff that goes along with granny units. And you've got an item coming up here tonight, and I hope you think about these issues, because it's not just, you know, about development in the abstract. It's really about building into our community with the people of our community in a way that the state says we have to do, and in a way that minimizes the impact on resources and our and the area outside of our town. It's a very good thing, and it's good for people that do it, because, you know, they can earn a little rent sometimes. It helps them out financially. Maybe they can put their kid through college with that money. There's all kinds of good things that
ended up being recalled because they started a project before the results of a recall election, which was based on Move the Sewer. When the county took the project over and their consultant for the EIR, all of a sudden, 8, 10, 12 sites outside of town popped up that were feasible locations. All of a sudden, they became feasible. They weren't feasible back in 2002, 2001. All of a sudden, they became feasible. I guess my concern is that we're in a bidding condition now where prices from contractors bidding on projects are below engineers' estimates. If you get outside of that window and prices start going up because you've dug your heels in and you're not willing to comply with the Coastal Commission requirements, and you get into that window where prices start going up, and materials prices are going to go up. The Japan problem alone is going to increase cost for materials around the world. Montgomery Watson Harza designed the project for Los Osos. They were shortlisted by the county to be one of the three bidders on the redesign of the new project that the county just decided to take on, formally took the project. Montgomery Watson Harza didn't even propose on the RFP. They were shortlisted, didn't even propose on the redesign. Why? Why didn't they defend what they did 8 years ago? That's the situation. We've told you about Montgomery Watson Harza here and at the JBA for the last year. That's what you're in for down the road, and why you haven't required them
to be
accountable for what they've done is beyond me. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Gary Johnson, resident of Morro Bay. I want to thank Morro Bay, Chief Pond, Woods, the Harbor Department, everybody. It went smoothly and great. I really appreciate it. I was down there through the whole episode. And the volunteer police people, we got to thank them. They did a super job. There were dozens of them down there. The volunteer police department. I was proud of everybody. Also, when an accident happens, at my age, I've been through I don't know how many earthquakes in Southern California, and every time there's an earthquake, the sky's falling. And everybody, oh my God, then after a while, you kind of dribble and you forget about it. Now we're through this tsunami and this earthquake. The sky's falling. And I appreciate what this gentleman said about this. He gave a great presentation about our nuclear area and not to be so concerned. And Chief Pond, you did a great job too on the potassium iodide, because I'm not a nuclear physicist, but I've been around it for 40 years in my career working on this space station and working with NASA. And so I'm very familiar with radiation. And like you can go skiing in Colorado and get more radiation than what they were expecting here. And remember that the tsunami killed over 10 to 15,000 people in Japan. How many people have died from nuclear energy? So we got to be careful that we don't all get excited and, oh, you know, like the Coastal Commission, oh, we got to stop the sewer plant right now. We got to stop it. Well, I disagree with that. Do you realize if we have a tsunami, and I got a minor in geology, so I know what I'm talking about, the way our plates are shifted here on the Central Coast, Japan's got three plates just grinding every day with each other. China's the same way. What do you think we have the Himalayas for? It's all because of that. So if we had a tsunami like some of these people are talking about, Cayucas is gone. Our high school's gone. The cloisters are gone. The beach track is gone. Morro Bay and Embarcadero's gone. Los Osos, my God, they're going to get wiped out. So this hysteria just gets out of control. We have to stop and think now before we jump ahead and start making rational decisions. So I hope when the Coastal Commission said, let's stop it and think about it, that's good. But just to say no, that's ridiculous. And you want to know why we have $500,000 here? Because of all these appeals. Every time these is costing the taxpayers
On the subject, so I'll just mention that, yes, on March 11th, the Coastal Commission did hear the appeals, but it wasn't for the project. It wasn't a de novo hearing. It's what's known as a substantial issue hearing. It's the first step in the process. The project was not denied on March 11th, as some of the speakers might have alluded to. The project is not in the stage right now to start over. It's not uncommon for all projects to require a substantial issue hearing and to go to a de novo hearing. Our Harbor Walk went to substantial issue and to a de novo hearing. The Anderson Inn did, Estero Inn, Roses Landing. You know, I could go on and on. I don't think there's any projects that don't go through. So I would have been more shocked if, in fact, they hadn't found a substantial issue, because this project required an EIR, and when an EIR is required, there's substantial issues that they want to take up. So there will be a de novo hearing that probably won't take place until at the earliest December meeting, probably more likely maybe even next year. So for the next 6 months, there'll be substantial issues that the JPA will have to hear and decide on, and probably the first and the major meeting will be the April 14th meeting, when staff hopes to bring back to you some rough estimates of the studies that would be required to get it to a de novo hearing. And those three major studies are an alternatives analysis, an update of our water reclamation feasibility study, and additional site-specific hazard information. Those are the three major studies that Coastal Commission staff wants to see further analysis on to make a final determination in their de novo hearing. So, I mean, those are the critical issues. Coastal staff did express an appreciation for city staff meeting with them after the March 11th Coastal Commission meeting. And, you know, we look forward to bringing that information forward to the JPA and for them making that decision on whether they want to do those additional studies.
Thank you. Would the council like to proceed into consent calendar or take a break? Charge right on. All right. Anyone like to pull anything from the consent calendar?
Move approval.
Okay. Moved by Councilmember Johnson. Second by Councilmember Borchert. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Consent passes. On to new business, which is item D1. Review and discussion of Morro Bay Municipal Code 17.48.320 regarding secondary dwelling units. Mr. Schultz.
Good evening. This item is being brought forward to you based on council's direction to take another look at our secondary dwelling unit ordinance. Briefly, in February of 2005, the city enacted a moratorium on secondary dwelling units in order to bring the city zoning into compliance with Government Code 65852.2. That was a recently enacted government code that basically stated that secondary dwelling units were having a difficult time being passed in cities, and therefore cities had to develop a process that allowed for secondary dwelling units to be approved through a ministerial process as opposed to a discretionary process, better known in our city as a CUP process. On February 22nd, the Planning Commission, and this is in 2005, held Planning Commission meetings and discussed the current state and local federal framework and took public testimony on the topic of secondary dwelling units. In March of that same year, the staff proposed an ordinance changes, and then in April, May, and in two council meetings in May, they considered the adoption and revisions to the Morro Bay Municipal Code Section 1748.320, and those are attached to your staff report. And so basically is tonight is to open it up for your discussion to see if there's any changes you want to make, and if so, the process that we would go through to undertake those changes. Today in the audience we have Kathleen Wald, who's our planning manager, and she can help me if there's any specific questions you might have as to how many maybe have passed through our doors on secondary dwelling units. I think that was one of the questions I was asked earlier, and I didn't have the answer for that. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Questions from the council?
Does she have the answer to that?
Do you know how many secondary dwelling unit projects we've had in the last year, 2 years, 3 years? Do you know how many have come through?
2005, we've had six.
Since 2005, under the new code would be interesting to know.
And then you're going to be required more parking, so I think that most people stay with the one parking space and one-bedroom units. That's what I've seen, at least.
Any other questions? Okay. Discussion?
I'm ready.
Then lead us away, Ms. Johnson.
All right. This is something I've looked at since I was on the Planning Commission. And I think there's probably, at least in my mind, a really easy way to handle this. First, we need to remember that the secondary dwelling units, which we tend to refer to as granny units, are actually one of our few sources of low-income housing in Morro Bay, and in our attempt to meet the state regulations for providing low-income housing. And I think when this was revised in 2005, there were a couple of things that happened that made it difficult for people to actually develop the secondary units. And if you look at the second page of our report from Mr. Schultz, he gives a summary of the ordinance amendments. And my suggestion would be to just line out number 3, because I think that's the part that is really limiting. And let me tell you one of the reasons I think that's so true from having talked to people and experienced this as a member of Planning Commission. Say you have a very small house. You bought it as your beginning house. And this has happened a lot of times. It's not just a fairy tale. But you buy a small house in the hopes of someday enlarging it, and then you don't get that done. And you want a larger house, yet you need some income. This prohibits you from building your larger house on the lot and then using the smaller existing house as a secondary living unit and getting some income from that. So I think if we eliminate this number 3, I mean, we still have the parking space requirements. I mean, there are some other things we could do and drag this out, But just based on my experience with this, I think that's the easiest and most effective way to go. Thank you.
Comments from the council?
I guess I do have a question that I would ask. Is there a reason that you were not allowing tandem parking for the secondary unit? Sorry, Kathleen.
Okay, as far as the tandem is concerned, we allow tandem for the single-family residence because you're required two. Because they're under the control of the same person, you know, the single-family resident. We don't allow the secondary unit to be in tandem with someone that they don't have control over the parking. So, for instance, that would be you live in the single-family residential home. I live in the secondary unit. I have to go knock on your door to ask you to move your car so I can get my car out. That we don't allow to occur. So we allow, through the parking exception that's provided for in the code, tandem parking is routinely allowed as an exception if you demonstrate you can't provide it in side-by-side traditional standard method. We don't allow two different parties to tandem with each other. And that's the prohibition.
Thank you for the clarification.
Just a minute, but how about the 20-foot setback? There's a reason you don't allow that either, right?
You mean the parking?
For the parking, yes, for the secondary.
We look at it as a case-by-case basis, so with the parking exception, I think we've seen that. Councilmember Johnson would probably could give you some background on that, but everything's looked at through the parking exception on a case-by-case basis. So if someone can't provide the parking, that's allowed too. We've had them sometimes allowed where they're in the right of way, because say for instance, you know, the actual improved street is fairly narrow, but the public right of way is very large, and if that sometimes that exception has been made given the circumstances of how a person finds their actual property. And staff has supported that also. And those have been approved at Planning Commission that way.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Wald?
Not at this time.
Okay. Not right now.
Ms. Borchard?
I support Councilmember Johnson's comments. I totally agree with eliminating the restriction. I think that we have a lot of small houses, so you could force somebody into only allowing secondary unit, to be 500 or 600 square foot, which would.
Well, I also agree with Nancy on this. To me, it just boils down to it's. This is a great way to grow without expanding. So, and the homeowners' use of these granny units is so versatile. I mean, with the way housing is and how expensive it is, a lot of people are moving in together. But also, you know, you're allowed to be able to keep your child at home before it goes to college and. There's just many, many uses for this besides renting it out to somebody else. So, I really believe in these granny units. It's a great way to go to meet our housing needs.
I guess I'm going to be the minority on this one. I've learned from my review of this item that there was a very extensive process to develop our existing code, and from the numbers that our staff's given us about the number of projects that have applied and been permitted, I don't see a very extreme barrier with our existing code. And I guess I would caution the majority of the council to not make major changes to something that was so carefully crafted if we could do some subtle tweaks that would still get us to the end goal of trying to make these more accessible. So that's my opinion, but you're free to make your own motion. And I guess my question would be, what would be the process from here if there was amendments supported tonight by the majority of the council? And I think that'd be a question for Mr. Schultz. Where would this then be a draft would be developed and then it would come to us, or what would that process look like?
That would be the decision of the council. Your choices are to bring it back directly to you or to bring it to the Planning Commission for them to take a look at. But that would be your decision. I've heard you discuss C and E. I would have similar discussion maybe on, F on the parking, if there's any changes you'd like to see there. And also, if you look at I, if you're removing C, I think you'd have to make some changes to I and the conditional use permit on the 9 and the 1,200 square feet issue.
You could just strike I out, couldn't you?
Along with C and E?
Well, E would be to just keep it reasonable, perhaps, and remove the detail of the type of windows and trim and things just read reasonably.
If I recalled, but I'd have to go back and do all the research on this, is most cities did have a ultimate maximum for a granny unit. I think most of them was 12. I think that's what the state law, 1,200, I think that's what the state law said. So I don't know if you want to strike it completely. I haven't done enough research on it.
So can we include that it would be following the state guidelines then? Rather than?
Yes.
I think one of the things that makes Morro Bay so unique in this situation are the number of very small single-family homes we have that if they tried to put in a granny unit, it would be just way too small with under this regulation. It just wouldn't work, whereas they could use the home in which they're living as their 1,200 square foot or whatever it is, granny unit, and build a larger one.
And Kathleen will be the first to jump up and correct me, but the way I thought this was worded, though, if in fact you had a very small home, you could come in with over a 1,200 square foot to put on there, and that would then become your primary, which would be the existing proposed living area of the primary dwelling. So you could flip-flop it under the current language. I always thought that was the intent.
I don't know. In reading C, the maximum floor area of a second unit shall not exceed 900 square feet or 50%, whichever is smaller, of the proposed living areas of the primary dwelling unit.
Right, which means you could take the proposed living area and make that your primary.
Let's come clarify that for us,
well,
Kathleen.
Well, regardless, it still has to fit in the envelope, no matter which way you do this, because you still have your setbacks and your lot coverage maximum, regardless of the two units, right?
Right, but he is correct. I mean, we have approved him that way. When people come in with really small homes on a fairly large lot, they'll accommodate another unit. We always give them that option. We always tell them that, obviously, 50% of like a 900-square-foot house is going to be very small, that they can always propose that as the second unit and build a larger home. And I wasn't here when this was done, but over there, there was one where, I don't know what street it's on, but it's like more towards the south of Acacia, and there's the little existing home and the big huge home.
If your home is only 1,000 square feet, then you could build that 2,000 square foot home. You're in the 50% ratio and be able to do it. But if you're in that, 900 to 1,200 range, it becomes difficult.
And that's what I think I'm looking at, and not forcing them for a conditional use permit every time and the cost of that.
That was my question then to Kathleen. On these where you've allowed the larger unit, with the smaller one, and by the way, I think the one you're mentioning on Acacia was built before 2005. I know that contractor. Anyway, so are they having to come for a conditional use permit to do that, whereas under the second dwelling regulations, they don't have to do that?
I'm sorry, what?
If it's over 900 feet, if it's going to be over 900 feet, then it has to go for a conditional.
Okay, so that kind of defeats the purpose in my mind, I think.
You're talking about flipping. If you were flipping, so if you were going to build the second unit.
Mm-hmm. Either way, even if you're not flipping it. Anytime
if your home was 1,200 square foot right now and you wanted to build the 2,000 square foot home, you would be required the CUP then. if you were going to change
right,
that.
Right, at any time the second unit was over 900 square feet. We just don't see them that often because, you know, once you get over 900 square feet, you're talking about more bedrooms, and most people want a granny unit to be subordinate and to provide, like you said, affordable housing. So, you know, it's very rare that you'd see a one-bedroom or studio-type granny flat at 1,200 square feet. That's a different kind of animal. So, you know, we just don't see them that big, and usually, you know, most people are trying to provide, like you've spoken about, ancillary housing or, you know, some type of housing for family members. So that's why I think these limits were put in place. I think there's also a concern that, well, what really is the difference between two full-fledged single-family residence, and so one has to be primary and one has to be subordinate. That's just the way the code is written. So, you know, there has to be some kind of parameters so we know which one actually is the primary. So that's just the way it's been.
I think a lot of that's going to be dictated by the size of the lot, though, again.
Right.
And the setbacks and everything. And so understanding there's restrictions, you know, if you feel more comfortable or it works out better that we go with the state guidelines that are 1,200 square foot, I'm fine with that, but 900 is just very limiting.
I agree.
So the suggestion then would be to simply up the limit to 1,200 to match the state and avoid making major changes to the rest of the code.
Well, yes, but I would also be wanting to remove a few of the other single line items on E and F about the architectural compatibility and on the secondary unit parking. Just line strikeout.
Okay. Would you like to?
I'll see if Ms. Johnson wants to.
I'm still over here marking up lines here. On C, I'm willing to go with the 1,200 square feet to line up with the state, but I would still like to have some more discussion or look at this first line where it says a second unit shall not exceed 900 square feet or 50%, whichever is smaller of the existing living area, or proposed living area. I don't know. There's still parts of that bother me a little bit.
So I can read it. The floor area of the combined primary and secondary dwelling units shall not exceed the maximum allowable amount for a primary dwelling without secondary unit. How's that?
Mine came out yellow instead of red, so I can't see it. That sounds good to me. I agree. What about your architectural compatibility? What do you want to take out?
On E, it would be removing the line, just striking out type of windows and trim details.
Okay.
And then substantially the same would be reasonably compatible.
Should be reasonably the same, yeah. That makes sense.
That's okay.
Yep. And how about
and
parking?
And then on F, on the parking, it was just striking out one, two, three, the fourth line, principal dwelling unit, and then striking out or secondary unit, and cannot be located in the front or side setback area. So it would still
definitely
say you couldn't do the tandem and those things. You still couldn't do that, but it just strikes that out.
Okay. What do you want to do about I?
Remove it.
Okay, just remove I completely. That sounds good to me. Do you want to talk about it some more, or shall we make a motion?
Certainly, from a staff standpoint, you know, we'll bring those back to you. There'd be a first and second.
1,200.
I don't want to force people for the conditional use permit. That's why I'd rather strike it out.
I would too, because the whole purpose of this is to avoid having to go for the conditional use permit, which has considerable cost for a person who's wanting to remodel, especially in this day and age, and you know the cost and the time and having to go through the whole process. I would like to just eliminate the conditional use permit for secondary dwelling units.
Well, if you'd like to, let's double check with staff, make sure that they.
No, I just wanted to bring up is as far as the public's concerned, although a CUP wouldn't be required. I mean, you still have the ability to appeal the administrative decision on a permit, correct, Kathleen? Right. So there's still an appeal process if a neighbor is unhappy because of the the impacts.
Okay. Would you like to go ahead with the motion? Staff, are you comfortable with the changes that were just discussed?
As I said, I'm not completely comfortable because we haven't provided analysis, but at least I know where you're heading on that. And
if we make a motion, then you could analyze it and come back and tell us what you think.
Yes.
I'll provide.
Thank you.
Mr. Schultz.
And there would be, it'd be for public hearing also, so the public could hear.
Okay.
All right. All right. Where do we start here? Help me with this, kiddo.
Okay, I will. I move that we direct the city attorney to come back with changes in conditions to item D1, striking out letter I. In F, striking out the line that says or secondary units and cannot be located in the front or street side setback. Under E, architectural compatibility, striking out type of windows and trim, substantially the same, and replacing it with reasonably. And on C, that the floor area combined and the secondary dwelling unit not exceed the maximum allowable amount of 1,200 square foot in guidelines with the state.
Second.
We have a motion from Ms. Borchardt, a second from Councilmember Johnson. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion passes 3-1.
Thank you.
Okay. Future agenda items. Anyone? Mr. League? All right. I'd just like to bring up the suggestion that was spoken to during public comments regarding a letter about the seismic study that has been signed and sent by the SLO Board of Supervisors, Santa Barbara Board of Supervisors, and Senator Blakeslee. And I'd just like to bring that back for a discussion and consideration of sending our own letter.
I don't want to get into that ball game. Thank you very much.
I'd support bringing it back for council discussion.
Thank you.
Yes, I think we ought to bring it back.
Okay. With that, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. We are adjourned. Thank you all for your patience. Thank you.